Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Soho Insider podcast. My name is Saad Usmani. I'm the chief of the myeloma service here at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And I'm joined by my wonderful colleague, Dr. Ethan Stein, who is the chief of the leukemia service here and really has spearheaded a lot of early drug development in the leukemias. And I wanted to just have a candid chat with him about what's exciting in the field. And more recently, you know, we've seen a lot of data coming out with menin inhibitors being incorporated into the schema of treatments, and want to learn more from Ethan. Ethan, welcome.
Thanks so much, Saad. Great. Glad to be here.
So can you tell me a little bit about, you know, the scientific rationale of using menin inhibitors, and where do you see them eventually fitting, you know, in the various leukemias?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting story in the following way. So it's been known for some time that there are certain types of acute leukemia, both myeloid and lymphoid leukemia, that the pathogenesis of those types of leukemia are mediated by the upregulation of HOX genes. For a long time, sort of how this happened and how the HOX genes were turned on was sort of less understood, but probably about 15 years ago or so, maybe even a little bit longer, it became clear that there was this macromolecular complex that consisted of a complex called KMT2A that required an adapter protein called menin to aberrantly bind into this complex to mediate the upregulation of these HOX genes. So that summarizes a lot of work over many, many papers and many, many years. But it then became clear that if you could block that interaction between menin and this KMT2A rearranged complex, you could get downregulation of the HOX genes, which would lead to myeloid differentiation or lymphoid differentiation and the reversal of the leukemic phenotype. So this is most relevant in really two different types of leukemia. One is acute myeloid leukemia and acute lymphoblastic leukemia, where there are what are called KMT2A rearrangements. So that occurs in about 5 to 10% of patients with acute leukemia, predominates in patients with therapy-related acute myeloid leukemia. And then it also occurs in patients with NPM1 mutant acute myeloid leukemias, where menin binds to the wild-type KMT2A complex, which also mediates HOX gene upregulation. About 30% of patients with newly diagnosed AML will have a NPM1 mutation. And then maybe we can talk about it a little bit later, but there are other subsets of leukemia where this may be relevant as well.
But can you tell me about all the work that you've done in this space in the early drug development?
Yeah, so this all came about actually. So Scott Armstrong was really a pioneer in the world of epigenetics and the world of KMT2A rearranged leukemias. This came about when he was here at Memorial Sloan Kettering leading our epigenetics center. And I was a young, just starting fellow. And I was fortunate enough that he, Ross Levine, Marty Tallman, and I would have coffee every other Monday morning and chat about things that they found interesting and I was trying to learn about. And he told me about this menin story, and that led to him introducing me to someone who eventually went on to work at a pharmaceutical company called Syndax Pharmaceuticals, where they developed the first menin inhibitor. So we, along with the MD Anderson Cancer Center and a couple of other centers, led the clinical trial of a drug called revumenib that was the first menin inhibitor in clinical development. It's the first menin inhibitor that has been approved by the FDA. And that was based on a clinical study that took revumenib and gave it to patients with KMT2A or NPM1 relapsed and refractory acute leukemias, and look to see what the response rates were. Response rates are quite high in KMT2A rearranged leukemias. The response rate is in the range of 60 to 70%, while the rate of complete remission, or what's called CRH, which is a complete remission with partial hematologic recovery, is a little bit lower at 30%, but about 70% of patients clear their blasts, about 20 to 30% of patients clear their blasts and have count recovery. And that allows a group of patients who really have a median overall survival without a menin inhibitor of probably less than 2 months to have an overall survival which exceeds that. I think the big issue with menin inhibitors is that they're not durable. So patients go into remission, they remain in remission for something like 6 to 9 months, but then they eventually relapse. And the question becomes, well, what can we do to prevent those relapses? How can we position this agent so it has the best chance of leading to the longest clinical remissions?
How do you think you're going to incorporate what you've learned for frontline strategies? Because, you know, there are certain other strategies that, including BCL2 inhibitor venetoclax, along with azacitidine or decitabine, has been touted as a preferred, more tolerable frontline strategy. So thoughts around that?
You know, I'm impressed, Saad, at your leukemia knowledge. I would not be able to rattle off any names of myeloma drugs, despite the very interesting data that came out of ASCO. So I think you're right. And I think that what we're trying to do in AML now is what you folks in myeloma learned a number of years ago, which is adding agents together and adding agents that are not particularly myelosuppressive together to augment the response rates and get higher rates of MRD negative complete remissions. So there are trials now that are combining revumenib and other menin inhibitors in combination with azacitidine and venetoclax, you know, in an effort to augment those responses, get deeper remissions from the beginning, including those combinations of menin inhibitors with intensive chemotherapy. We're now, you know, we're talking in AML, like you guys have talked about for a while, about quadruplets. We're going to hopefully be giving menin inhibitors with FLT3 inhibitors and azacitidine and venetoclax. And I think that what you all have done in myeloma is what we're looking to do in leukemia, which is combinations of agents with different mechanisms of action to get extremely high response rates, which hopefully lead to more durable remissions and allow more people to have successful allogeneic stem cell transplants, which seems to be still the best anti-leukemia therapy in 2025.
No, that's outstanding. I think it's really remarkable to see where we've come from and where we are going. So, you know, I'm going to end the podcast by asking a forward-thinking question, maybe a little provocative. Leukemias are the subset of disease where we're still allogeneic stem cell transplantation, you know, has a significant role and probably one of the few curative strategies that has stood the stem, you know, test of time. So 10 years from now, if you had a crystal ball, how would you think the acute leukemia treatment approach would be different from where it is now?
Well, I'll tell you what I'd like to see. What I'd like to see is that we're giving very intensive combinatorial therapy up front, which leads people to become MRD negative by very, very deep molecular sequencing. So at levels of 10 to the minus 6. And then that allows us to monitor those patients for the relapse of MRD, but that we don't necessarily need to transplant all of those intermediate and high-risk patients up front. I mean, 10 years from now, what I'm hoping is that transplant is reserved for patients with the highest risk disease, but that we're able to give intensive therapy up front and then move to a maintenance strategy where you're giving targeted agents as your maintenance approach, with those targeted agents having many fewer side effects than the AZA-VEN intensive chemotherapy that we're giving. So I think we're going to see significant improvements in the duration of response and the duration of survival or in overall survival. I think we're going to be doing fewer and fewer transplants, allogeneic transplants, because we're going to be basing our decisions on transplants on really very sensitive MRD testing. And I mean, we still need better drugs. Hopefully there's going to be a CAR-T strategy for acute myeloid leukemia, which unfortunately really hasn't turned out so well yet. But if we can do that, and then I think we're going to be, and or the patients will be in good shape, you know, when I get out of this business and go off to retirement and playing golf somewhere.
Yeah, you and me both, my friend. thank you so much, Ethan, for sharing. Sure.